Okay, good afternoon, everybody. It's my great pleasure to introduce Kim Horton from the University of Adelaide to talk about redundancy with Linux. Take it away, Kim.
Right. Just to give you an idea, everyone knows what DNS is? Good. And DHCP? And NTP? Cool. This afternoon. What I'm really here to talk to you about is the project that I worked on at Adelaide Uni last year. And so what I'm going to do is talk you through the whys, some of the decision making, what we wanted to do, and then how we did it, and then some wrap-up stuff we did afterwards, the lessons about it. And then I'll allow plenty of time at the end for questions, because there's quite a lot of stuff to cover. And I want to try and give you the context, which is really what I'm trying to impart, because there's a lot of technical detail, and there's lots of other stuff online which I can really show you sort of like at the end during questions. So, okay. Why do we need redundancy? I mean, it's nice having, your big data center with all your kit in it, everything in one place. Get everything nicely organized, and then the worst possible things that can happen. This data center got a bit wet. This building had 100 tons of water go through it. 40 tons of water went through this room. Nothing made it out alive. I've since been here, and it's just an absolute nightmare. Now, if there's one thing you can take away, you never, ever have a single data center. Never, ever put all your eggs in one basket. It's that simple. You can't afford to if you want to have a reliable network. You can't afford to put all your data in one place. So, when this happened to this particular place, they spent an awful lot of time fixing it up. I've since been there. There's millions of dollars worth of refurbishment work going back in. So we looked at this at our network and went, wow, we don't want that to happen to us. So we sat down and figured out all the things that we needed to do so we'd never have that problem. So if you have a data center and you want to start making things more redundant, you want things more reliable, you have to figure out what your core services are. So one of the things we did was we went and talked to our users, and they said, these are the most important things on our network. Email, phones, so we have phones on PBXs, then we have applications on web servers and other things like that. And then we had other apps like HR and finance and all that other sort of stuff. And the amusing thing is that web apps a couple of years before was under the other apps, so we're moving lots more stuff into web apps. So there's lots of services there going on in terms of the high-level stuff that users see. So we looked at this and went, wow, that's a really big, hard problem. So we thought, what are the dependencies for this? What are the underlying things that we really need to look at that all this stuff depends on? Well, really that's the network hardware and the servers running those services. And the absolute core services that we want to be absolutely running all the time are DNS, DHCP, and NTP. Because when you start thinking about it, that user can't get to their inbox, to the mail server, if they can't convert the name to an IP. Oh, crap. So how do they get an IP in the first place? Oh, well, we'll give them one from DHCP. And then how do we make sure that all those services are all synced up in time in the first place? Well, we like NTP for that, so we want to make sure that they're all running all the time. And they're not all in that same data center. So when this project was first put together, which is before I joined the university, they asked all these questions. They went through this whole concept about what they wanted to do. And this is where they went. They went and talked to people everywhere. There's quite a big group there at the uni, and there's an OS support group and a networking group. And talk to vendors for Cisco, whose switches we use, to other vendors of switches. And we talked to other local unions where we were. And there was a couple of posts out for various lugs and things about, you know, questions. And so there's lots of research done on that. Now, if you're looking for this kind of stuff to start with, it's actually quite a big, complicated field to look for the specific things you really should be doing. There's no checklist which says, for DNS, do this. So what we did was put together a list of goals that we quite specifically wanted to implement, and we broke it all up like this so that we'd have three separate projects, and so that these things would be implemented independently and they didn't depend on service for each other, otherwise, you know, we could have some issues there. So, okay, so what we did, okay, so what I'm looking at here is my why, what, how, where section. The why really is we had a DNS server as a primary and a DNS server as a secondary, or two secondaries. So we wanted to add more redundancy than that, because if the first DNS server goes down, all your clients got to wait for your second DNS server when they 60 seconds later when they send their next request. The second thing we're looking at there was the hardware refresh. We had some quite old machines we wanted to replace, so we bought new hardware to do that on, and we're replacing Red Hat 7 with Red Hat AS4. Now, these machines have been in place for a long time before this project happened. And patches were an issue. Getting patches for Red Hat 7 was quite a problem. And thankfully, they were moving lots of stuff from AS3 to AS4 from the rest of the services. And of course, we'd be upgrading Bind 9 while we're doing it to a more recent version. Now, if we go back here, the things that are important that we were looking at was we wanted redundant services, but we also wanted to make sure that we're using native package management. Now, there are a lot of things that you want that are more bleeding edge than what Red Hat AS4 provides. And the other thing is that some of the packages on AS4 don't actually work. I'll get to that in a minute. So, we've got to try and keep these things sort of in context. So what we did was, on the internet and talking to various people, we found a whole bunch of really cool ideas. One of them was Anycast IP. I'll cover this a little bit later, but basically what you're looking at is you can have a bunch of servers, all with the same IP, on a loopback interface, and via Quagga. We hook in via the OSPF routing frame with our Cisco routers, and we say, this IP address is here, and here, and here on our network. But what this allows us to do is that the closest one to the client will be where the traffic is sent to the DNS request. The next part is pretty obvious. I mean, we had an existing primary secondary tree where we had a name server push out updates. We had our own host database, and it pushed out updates as well. And we're using Quagga on the host itself, pushing out the route updates to the OSPF tree. Right. When I started writing this talk, I was trying to think of a nice little catchphrase to say what Anycast IP and DNS was all about. And it's really this concept of less is more. We have two IP addresses that are our DNS servers internally on the network. So with those two IP addresses, we say, tell every single client, that's it, there's only two. You'd be surprised how many clients can only handle their two DNS servers. So that's why we chose that. And two IP addresses is all you really need when you're using Anycast, because if the first one goes away, you do your next query, and by the time that timeout has happened, it actually sends you to the next DNS server, because if the first one goes away, it's down, and that next quest goes out to the next hop across the network to the next closest DNS server. Right. This is another one of the aims we did, was to locate servers physically close to your client. We haven't got a complicated network, really. It's three campuses across Adelaide. So we bought four new servers, and we put one at the remote ones and two in the middle. So that put us, with a recently upgraded DNS server, that put us three centrally and one at each campus. So the main idea there is that clients on remote campuses query their local DNS server and the updates get pushed out to them from the primary to secondary DNS. So if one of those DNS servers goes down on the remote campus, the router just says, oh, well, the next closest one is central, so I'll just forward the packet down the link. Routers. So this is the part where Anycast is quite simple. I mean, it's Anycast IP is just like unicast IP. There's nothing complicated about it. It just says, there's the closest route. And because these hosts run OSPF, it all happens automatically. You don't see it. There's no client config involved. You don't have to change DNS server IPs or any of that mucking around. It all happens transparently to the user. You deploy your image, you deploy it on your client, and you don't need to change it. And if you replace the DNS server with a new one, you take the IP address down there, you bring that IP address up on the new server, and there's no changes to your client, which is why this whole concept of the less is more for DNS was really, really attractive. Now, the other thing we were trying to achieve was the location diversity. Obviously, that's the, you know, putting close servers close to your clients, and LAN diversity. So we have multiple networks, multiple NICs on the servers, so we make sure we have plenty of reliability there. The next project was DHCP, and we wanted to make sure that we could tie together these things, And the reason we upgraded DHCP was to get a hold of some new features in DHCP. The main thing being the failover. So previously we had one DHCP service serving the whole campus. So that's like 15,000 machines. So it gets a fair hammering. So we wanted to try and spread that load out and add redundancy. And while we're doing the hardware refresh, take advantage of that, push these services out onto these new servers. Now, we already used a thing called the Cisco IP Helper, which is just a line in the Cisco config, and it says, whenever you see a DHCP request, forward it to this IP. Now, we wanted to put in the failover. So what we then did was we put in a second line which says IP helper server 1, IP helper server 2. So for every VLAN we had and every subnet that on those VLANs, we had to put a line in on a Cisco router that says whenever you see IP helper, replace it and send it to those two DHCP servers. So that's a huge lot of work when you've got a big network and 800 VLANs and stuff, but it's definitely worth it. And obviously add redundancy is part of that why of this step. Okay, so this is the part what the failover pairs. The beautiful thing about the failover pairs is you say, here's two DNS servers, they talk to each other, they send each other, I have this lease for this client. And it has a little metric which says, out of all the IPs in the subnet, we can like say, you handle 60% of the load and you handle 40% and things like that. So we can set up these failover pairs to effectively load balance. And so you can protect some links that are slower and you can say, handle more leases locally and handle some remotely and things like that. So we cut the network up into three zones, the middle campus, the north campus and the south campus. And so what we decided to do was we'd have three failover pairs, one that just handled the centre campus, and then we had a third host on the main campus, which was the secondary for the south campus, and it was also the secondary for the north campus. And the beauty about that was we could sort of like tweak the config so that the local servers handled most of the load, and the one in the middle, you know, kind of, it was doing other stuff as well, so we protected a little bit by dropping down that lease load. Yeah, and so also there, the Cisco IP helper stuff, you know, we had to change each on about 7 core routers to send to the right IP addresses. So, okay. Again, this is part of the locate your servers where they need to be near the client. And so this is the 50-50 split we did for the central campus, and we can make the split more like 70-30 for the remote campuses or whatever, you know, it seems like a good number. You can sort of play with that. It shares the load quite nicely. One server will actually, when it gets hammered, it will actually disconnect from the remote from the other failover pair when it's overloaded, and sometimes it'll take itself offline, and the other server will pick up the load. It's quite entertaining to watch the logs, as you can see these things go through, going, I'm disconnecting, and so I'm popping into the failover state or the, and as they come back again, you can see them like disconnect over a period of 10 minutes. You can see the load going up and down on each of the servers by the amount of traffic between them. All right. What we're doing in NTP. We're already peering with a Strata 1 server over the internet. And we had an NTP server, and being it would be then Strata 2. So we wanted to have more servers on campus. So these four new boxes all became NTP servers as well. Now, the nice thing about that is that we then had four machines in our peering group for NTP. And if you want to go and have a look at the, the model for this, it's called the Byzantine Fault Tolerance Problem, and it's a really, they've got a really nice description on Wikipedia about the trust model that you have to have when you have less than three servers. So it talks about keeping accurate time and the model in which you use to tell which clocks are good and bad. Okay. So our existing server ran Stratum 2. We added these four peers in Stratum 3 and we made them a peer group so that they would keep a much more accurate clock against each other and keep themselves in sync, and they'd use our Stratum 2 server as a peer. So they'd primarily look at that one as the right one and then other stuff out on the net as well. So what we then did was all of the servers that we wanted to connect to, that we wanted to have accurate time, we pointed all of those guys at the local three of, time servers. So if we were on the North Campus, we'd point to the North Campus server and two on the Central Campus. And the same for the South Campus, we do the same sort of thing. Now, we used the standard version that came with Red Hat AS4, which is the IC from IC. Out of the bag, that just works. There's no mucking around with that one. Some NTP clients only allow you to put two time servers in, but it's probably not such a big deal for clients. It's more of an issue for servers where we were concerned about comparing stuff in logs, because you would get vast quantities of logs, and we have a central log server. So we wanted to make sure that the servers that were sending logs to the log server was in sync with everything else there, because we often have to pull out a pair of machines' logs and go, this client was doing this and the Squid Proxy was doing this, we want to make sure times were working out and things like that, where it's actually quite important to have time down to, a second or so for our purposes, but there's other things that we use for trying to debug NFS and other things like that, where we actually want hundreds of a second and stuff like that. So. This goes back to the beginning where, when we were doing the actual research for this, we didn't really know where to start. I certainly didn't when I first started, because when I signed up for the job, it was, you'll be admitting a few Red Hat boxes, and I went, okay, I can do that. And there were these things like the really redundant stuff that I hadn't played with before. So this is quite a big project when you look at what's actually involved in the software, from the software side and the hardware side. But more importantly, you've got to tie in with potentially dozens of people within an organisation like the Uni of Adelaide. ITS is only 150 odd people. But the process that goes on, like you've got to interface with change control, you've got to make sure it all gets approved, you've got to slot it into an outage window, you've got so many people you need to talk to. So getting approval for these things is actually a big deal. I mean, software, configuring this stuff is a small chunk of what you're actually trying to achieve. Because you've got a service, you want to deploy the service, you've got to make sure that before you do that, that it works and test it, that's not a problem. But the people that know what you're trying to do, when you're trying to do it, the business itself actually understands it and proves it and things like that, and you let your users know what's going on. So we actually spent quite a lot of time talking to groups within ITS trying to figure out what we're doing. So the main thing here was that we had this idea that we wanted to use Anycast DNS. And it's not a complicated thing, really, the concept of it. But convincing our network guys that this is what we wanted to do was really hard. Approaching them, saying, you know, we've got this idea and we want to add servers on the network and we want to put routing on them. That was actually the hardest hurdle, because there's actually quite a distinct groups where we work. And we've got an OS group and we've got a network group. And they don't talk to each other sometimes. So you've got to sort of have a good dialogue with these guys. You can go and talk to your network guys and say, right, okay, I've got this idea, we're going to put routing on here, and they went, no. Okay, we want to use Anycast, no. All right, why don't we want to do this? Oh, it was just a matter of saying to them, you know, what's the issue? What are the other things to overcome? So, I mean, the social lessons here for me, because I worked in lots of small organisations where I was the IT guy and I did everything. So it's one of those things where the actual social aspects of this project were more difficult. When I talked to the local team, I said, I want to do these servers. We went through the side of the concept we came up with, and that's all good. That shouldn't be a problem. So that's these first two points here. It's getting things working within the organisation was quite entertaining at the time. Now, I spent about a month looking at the research part of it. So what is this Anycast thing? Because these guys had come up with this idea before I started. So I had to sort of get my head around all of this sort of stuff. And looked everywhere and searched for lots of things. And I eventually came up with this paper, which is over here. This is pretty much all you need to know in order to implement Anycast DNS. There's two papers, I should say. Come on. These two papers have lots of information about implementing Anycast DNS. I'm not going to go through the real technical stuff in the talk. I'll leave that to the questions. But everything is literally in these two papers. It talks about, you know, the model of it. It talks about how you deploy it, configure things up, and stuff like that. So I spent a lot of time in this research part, and we got the concept approved, and they said, your date is here, we put all the schedule to change in, go. So we then actually went into testing and actually implementing this thing on a test rig on a separate part of the network, you know, we deployed DNS, we deployed DHCP and Quagga for the routing and all these things. And so I actually spent most of my testing time trying to get things like Quagga working, because unfortunately there was a bug in the Red Hat package and recompiling and all sorts of other things. We blew about a good solid week just trying to make that go. Thankfully Red Hat released the next version of Quagga with that fixed, and so within about a day we had a working model. And that literally took a day to make this whole thing work. Implement all these services on this box, sorry, on these five boxes. It took a little while to get VLANs and things like that all configured on our switches to make everything happy. But I mean, it was really not too much trouble to actually implement this stuff. Okay. The technical lessons about this really is, if you have a big complex network, VLANs make a lot of work because you've got to go and interface a lot of people and go, can you turn these ports on these switches onto this VLAN and do all that sort of stuff. So, VLANs are actually a really, really cool tool for doing this kind of thing, because it allows you to set specific IP helpers for different networks and shoot them off to different routers and DNS servers and stuff. That's really, really neat. However, I had a little problem, and I had one of my interfaces which wasn't on a VLAN, was on a long VLAN, so I was poking routes into the router that shouldn't have gone there. So when you're playing this stuff, make sure it's not on your production network. That was bad. Okay. And NTP needs three machines upstream to get the right time. Sort of covered that before, but that's really important, because one machine can wander really badly. And sometimes if you've only got two NTP servers, you don't know which one it is, so you can't trust either. So you just forget it, and then you wander. So What would be really cool if you could actually put a hardware clock, an accurate hardware clock, into your actual NTP server, preferably something that gets time from a real time source like GPS, GPRO, or CDMA. I mean, CDMA ones are quite expensive, GPS ones aren't too bad, but GPS is probably the most accurate time source that you can get for a reasonable cost, like, you know, under $500. Failing that, I'm sure everyone affords a, you know, atomic clock, but perhaps not. All right. This is really where I got everything. This is all the resources that I used for this project. It's just a few URLs. It doesn't look like a lot, but there's an amazing amount of detail packed in there. These slides will be up on the net later, so you're welcome to go and have a look at this. Probably the most scary thing in here is Quagga. Quagga is actually an implementation after Zebra, sort of inherited the source from Zebra, and it's attempting to be a Cisco-like routing interface. It's really quite good. I mean, performance isn't too bad. It implements OSPF and BGP. I've used it quite a lot over the years, so it didn't take me long to get this project going. But the documentation is a bit on the, how shall we say, rough side. It's okay. Now, this is a model, not an accurate one, but a model of our network. So you can sort of see that it's a bit complex when you start talking about where all the clients are connected and where all the servers live. I mean, the idea was that we're going to have some redundancy where the server itself was going to be close to the clients. And in some cases, we have the server plugged into the gigabit backplane of the core router, and then all our distribution switches with all our clients plug into the next blade of that backplane. So really, this is where I want to break for questions, because I didn't really cover a lot of technical stuff. I've got some other info here, those other slides, which I can show you examples and stuff. So specifically from these two papers, because this is where all the really complicated stuff is. The concept is simple, it's just the implementing bit is quite fiddly. So if you guys want to break out a mic.
Where are you? Raise your hand. Thank you.
Sure.
I was hoping there'd be some kind of war stories, if you like, about you know, the challenges that you face. For example, what were the issues with getting DNS working with Anycast, and what were the issues with getting the DHCP failover working, and did you have any problems with the scalability of DHCP?
Well, we kind of shortcutted the scaling issues of DHCP by setting up a couple of pairs of servers. So we really had big problems with our previous DHCP server because there was one. And there was these 15,000 machines, and at 9 o'clock in the morning, the machine would nearly go under. So this is that main drive to put in the redundancy for DHCP. So we used to have it set up such that a machine would get a DHCP lease once a day. However, there's some problems with that. Like certain laptops would get on the network and they'd pull a DHCP lease and they'd be gone 20 minutes later, and with student labs and things, you could get 200 or 300 people through that room in a day. And if it's only a subnet with 64 IP addresses in it, there's a real problem there. So we ended up moving the lease time to about an hour. So we made some changes when we scaled stuff up. We had to scale down the time frame because we had a lot more servers we could do that, and it wasn't really a problem.
How many machines did you have? How many addresses were you serving off the DHCP servers? You know, like
how many machines?
Yeah, how heavily loaded were the DHCP servers? How many how many requests were they looking after, sort of thing?
Well, we had in the order of about 25,000 requests a day originally, And literally most of those would be in the first hour and a half of the working day. And then because it does a query initially, and then when the lease expires, it does another one, obviously. But most Windows boxes do another query halfway through the lease to make sure that they make it all the way through. But because most boxes kick on at 9 in the morning, the second lease doesn't come through. Request doesn't come through because that's outside the working day. But in terms of the number of requests, that's kind of gone up quite a lot more now because we do a request every hour. We set the lease time to an hour. So the client does a request, and then half an hour later it does a confirmation request, and then half an hour later, and so on. So you see there's a lot more load there, but there's a lot more servers now there to pick that up. Got any more questions?
DNS war stories?
To be honest, I never really suffered a lot of those because we already had primary and secondary DNS. We also already had a bunch of servers doing that. We already had a host database server that pushed our updates. So really I didn't have any problems there. I mean, all that infrastructure was already in place, and it was literally a matter of copying that, dropping it on a new box, and it went. Apart from the SE Linux stuff, that was a pain in the butt. But other than that, we didn't have any real problems.
Okay, I have two questions. The first one is, what tools did you use to do benchmarking of your DHCP and DNS servers while they were in the lab?
Conveniently, we had 5 web servers in development to go into production at the same time. They each had a pair of gigabit interfaces on them, and we set the lease times to be quite low on the server at the time. And we had a script there with multiple virtual interfaces on the second NIC, and we pushed out DHCP on those ones at the same time. We had some issues with that initially, but then we went, no, okay, VLAN trunking, and so we could do a couple of thousand requests a minute. We never really pushed it past that because we didn't sort of think there was a great deal of point. We just wanted to make sure it was handled pretty well under load. So there's no real formal testing there, but we made certain that, you know, it didn't fall over if it had, you know, 100 simultaneous requests. Any more questions? Sure.
Can you tell us about Anycast, please?
Sure. Actually, let's put better diagrams over here. All right. So, I've got better diagrams here somewhere. So realistically what we're looking at is we've got a bunch of routers and a bunch of DNS servers connected to them and a client. So each server is announcing, I'm on, in this instance, 128.2.10. So each DNS server has a loopback interface configured that looks a bit like, basically each of these So each loopback interface has an IP, and it has a net mask of 32 bits. So that host route gets pushed around the network. So what this means is that the host announces, I have this route to one IP. The router then advertises that back upstream. And then when those routers get more than one route to that single IP address, as you would normally expect to get in a, like an OSPF network, you'll actually get multiple paths to the single IP address, it will choose the best one from whatever the metric is that you've set up. So, in this instance, it set a path from the client to the middle server because that's the best metric to get there. I haven't really got enough time to explain all of Anycast IP in any kind of detail, but this paper has everything in it you need to know to implement. Like I said, the URL's up there. But the easiest thing to know is that when that server goes down, you've got about 2.5-3 seconds for the rest of the network to know but that IP isn't in our network anymore, and all the routers will pull it out. And this, we did a lot of testing around to make sure this stuff worked, because there was literally hundreds of routing events going through in our test network only time, and to drop servers and bring them back up again. We had scripts to do all this kind of stuff. And we never lost connectivity while we were doing it, while we were, you know, having these five clients hammering our five servers and stuff like that. So.
Two quick questions. With the boxes, which were actually, did you have any dedicated just to DNS or DHCP, or were they sort of services on all the services on the single machine? Were you actually running just a machine with which had just DNS or just DHCP, or were they sort of all shared?
Because we had these five servers around the campuses, we thought we might as well make lots of use of that infrastructure, because DNS by itself isn't really very expensive on CPU or memory in our instance. DHCP isn't really that heavy a load except at 9 o'clock in the morning, and NTP hardly is any load at all. So we really put DHCP, DNS and NTP on all five servers, and we really hit 15% CPU. They're HP Deal 380s, pair of Xeons, 4 gig of RAM, they tick over.
One other very quick question. With the Anywhere IP, you said if it drops off the IP, it pretty much goes to another one. What happens if just the service itself stops, but the IP is still there?
Okay, this is where we deployed a lot of scripts, and we monitored the DNS server directly, and we said, if the server goes down, drop the interfaces. Quagga went, oh shit, the interfaces are gone, and then announced that straight back out, it's Ethernet interface to the next router, and went, these IP addresses have gone, pull them out of your route table. So that's kind of like the beauty of the Anycast IP model, is that you've got a script sitting there polling, or not polling, it's polling the DNS server going, you know, do this DNS request, do this DNS request, do this DNS request, I didn't get it. Check again, pull the interface down. I mean, that's really simple. But that's literally what our scripts do. And then they send us email, because they don't use their own DNS servers. They use a central one, which is kind of handy when you can't send mail if you don't have a DNS server. So that's a little gotcha, but...
I wasn't quite clear. Are you any casting the NTP and the DHCP, or just DNS?
Just the DNS IP, because all of those services are any castable, except that with time, you really want to know that server A is really server A, and it's kind of complicated when server A and server B's clocks drift apart, and you go, give me the time. 5 seconds, give me the time, 6 seconds, give me the time. And because that server went down, your request gets rerouted, and then it says, oh, I'm at, you know, 3 seconds. So you've got to adjust your clock back, and then sometimes you can sort of like skip all over the place because you, and so we didn't decided not to do that. We decided to give the clients and the servers all of them, and this is why the Byzantine model is there, simply because you can't trust a single clock. You have to have a lot of them to compare. Question over here.
Would it be right in saying that you can only have one Anycast address per router?
Say that again.
You can only have one Anycast address per subnet.
Per subnet?
Yeah. Well, because you're using the OSPF over the routers to resolve that address.
So what we did was we had a VLAN on each of the servers, so they're all in the separate VLANs on the network, and then we had allocated another subnet just for the Anycast IP addresses.
Oh, okay.
So every single instance of an IP on that subnet is a /32. It's a host route, only a host route. We don't have anything else on a bigger subnet.
Okay.
For that reason. So we can broadcast any number of those IP addresses in Unicast around the network.
Could you have used layer 4 switching for that?
Pardon?
Layer 4 switching on those switches?
I don't know. Oh. We went with the OSPF model because we already implemented OSPF. We already implemented Anycast, as it turns out, even though the network guys didn't want to let us do it. And when we figured that out, it was like, well, what services do you use Anycast for? And they went through a big list of services, and they're all about talking between routers, and they didn't want to let stuff out of that space. So it turns out we gave them a log on the server and said, you can have full access to the router on the box, and they're happy, and then gave us the Anycast, and it was all fantastic after that.
Okay, one more question.
Any more questions?
A couple of people have wondered if many routers support /32 routes happily. Have you noticed any problems at all with that? Router support for /32 routes.
We have not had any problems. Certainly in the initial test phase, we had some issues configuring it up, but the /32 seems to be supported really well on the version of Catalyst, the Cisco routing blade that we have on our 6509. And it certainly works well on the Zebra. Quagga.
Which iOS were you running?
Pardon?
Which iOS?
Don't know.
Okay. And I'm assuming that when you're talking about DNS servicing, you're talking about DNS caching, not authoritative. Is that correct? Recursive caching, not authoritative.
I can't remember how we implemented that. That was kind of complicated. What we ended up doing was literally taking a lot of the configuration information from the existing DNS config and putting it onto the new boxes. We really didn't play with a lot of that. If you want to have a read up on what we did, there's another paper here I've got by Glenn Turner, and that talks more about the caching information. And it's got a couple of implementations about how you do that. So I actually want to refer you to that paper rather than not sure, to be honest. Okay, I think we'll wrap it up there.
Thank you, Kim.